Welcome to Desi Collective with Meera Kaimal and Anjana Nagarajan Bhutani. Today, we're going to talk about climate change for our series, Our Climate is Changing, Why Aren't We? We are pleased to be joined by climate change activist Campbell Scott. Campbell is a research scientist who worked at IBM. Currently, he volunteers with the Climate Reality Project and works as a member of the Speakers Bureau in its Silicon Valley chapter. Campbell will be talking to us about why energy storage is important for a sustainable economy. Hi, Campbell. Welcome to Desi Collective.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
So, Campbell, many of us watched in disbelief as Texas lost power after two devastating winter storms. It was mid-February 2021, and over 4 million homes and businesses lost power for several days. Campbell, you say this disaster was preventable. Tell us why. What went wrong in Texas? What caused the blackout? And what could have been done to avert it?
First of all, the Texas grid is not properly winterized. They had a similar power failure a decade ago, 2011, and they were advised by Federal Regulatory Commission to winterize their grid. They did not do that. So the grid itself was vulnerable. Even conventional fuel generation was vulnerable because gas pressures fall in cold weather. And so these power stations were not getting an ample supply of natural gas. The second thing is they did not have any backup supply. So that's where stored energy comes in. If they had had some measure of battery installation, they could have at least tempered the effects of the failed grid. The third thing is that Texas is isolated from the rest of the country. There are two major grids, one on the east side of the country, basically up to the Rocky Mountains, and then west of the Rocky Mountains, there's a second grid. And power doesn't flow very well from grid to grid, but it does flow within the grid. So when here in California, if we have a power shortage, we get power from Oregon and Washington and maybe Nevada, Utah, where there's excess power and we buy power from them. Texas can't do that because it's not connected either to the eastern grid or the western grid. And so they didn't have that other backup source of supply from somewhere else.
Most of us in California have experienced rolling blackouts during the hottest days in our summers. Why do power companies have to implement rolling blackouts during periods of extreme weather?
The bottom line is really that when the demand for power exceeds the available supply, something's got to give. And if, you know, if they can't, if there's no storage there, or they're using all available storage, they're using all available resources from across the grid that they are connected to, they have to shut something down. So what they do is they take smaller areas, local areas, you know, community or even, you know, few city blocks, and shut the power down there to keep the load balanced so that they can supply everyone else. And then to spread the pain, they bring that back or shut something else down and bring the first one back up. And then and so, and that's what they mean by rolling. They spread the pain by going from region to region or area to area, so that it may be out for a couple of hours, but most people, you know, don't lose their freezer full of food in a couple of hours. It lasts until the power comes back on.
Just like you alluded just now, Campbell, the electrical grid is a complex system, right? Where the power supplied and the demand has to be equal at any moment. But with green energy, the wind doesn't always blow, as the saying goes, and the sun doesn't always shine. Is that why energy storage is becoming increasingly necessary?
Yes, that's the primary reason. Clearly, you know, if the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, you need to get the power from somewhere else. And batteries can do that if they're already charged. but also you want to overcome a failure. So, you know, even the conventional grid, as in Texas, failed and there was no backup. I would say another very important reason is the flexibility it gives to the grid operator. So if in periods of low demand, they're generating more power than is being used, they have the flexibility to start putting that in storage. And so they keep their generators running. They don't have to shut down the generators, the wind turbines, or turn off the solar cells. That can be done, but it's inconvenient and it's wasting all that energy that's still pouring into them. So it's a way of keeping the load balanced as well by diverting excess energy into the storage system.
So Campbell, let's get into the science of energy storage.
Can you tell us, how do we store energy generated by coal, natural gas, and nuclear differently than the way energy produced from renewable sources like wind and solar? And why is it different?
So conventional power, fossil fuels, are really their own storage. Coal in a bunker, solid coal in a coal bunker, is a source of chemical energy. And when you want it, you get a shovel and you put it in the furnace. Similarly, oil, you know, or gasoline going into your tank in your car, that's already stored underground at the gas station, goes into your car, stored in your tank until you turn on the ignition. And similarly with natural gas, you know, it's in canisters or pipes or stored somewhere in tanks and delivered by pipes to your home. That's the biggest difference. The problem is that electrical energy itself is not directly storable. It runs down the wire, and when it's running down the wire, that's fine. You throw the switch and you get your electric power, but that's not stored in any real sense. You need to convert that electrical energy into some other form of energy. And the most common example are batteries. That's electrochemical storage.
There are many different battery technologies, aren't there?
There are many forms of battery, starting with very familiar lead acid batteries have been around for well over 100 years. I think they were invented in the 1870s or so. And in the mid 20th century, around the Second World War, when oil and gasoline were scarce, a lot of vehicles were switched to electrical power using lead acid batteries. I remember growing up with milk carts in the street. Short haul delivery like that is actually very well suited to battery powered vehicles. Now with lithium ion coming in, and they were developed in the latter part of the 20th century, primarily and motivated by portable devices, cell phones and laptop computers, where the weight was important. And lead acid batteries are not very portable. You have 100 times the weight of your cell phone in the battery alone. That doesn't work. But then the technology improved. Tesla, among others, started putting them into vehicles, into cars, where again, for smaller vehicles, weight is somewhat important. You don't want the battery to be more to the vehicle that it's in.
That leads right into the whole range issue, doesn't it? When you deal with batteries and transportation?
Everybody worries about whether they can get to the next charging station when they're making a cross-country trip. For that, especially for heavy vehicles, talking about trucks, trains, even ships, hydrogen becomes a storage medium. That is gaseous hydrogen. It's a light element, very light itself, but it has to be stored in pretty heavy containers because it's stored under high pressures. So the storage there is the tank that the hydrogen is in. But when you get to these heavy vehicles, it becomes the storage medium of choice for long haul vehicles and heavy vehicles. And they're going to a large extent point to point, go from a distribution center to a local distribution center. So you just need hydrogen refueling at two places, at the two ends of the route. There are other storage mediums. Thermal energy is stored, and You know, even something as simple as a storage heater, very popular in cold climates. Canada and the northeast of this country and northern Europe have thermal energy storage where the rest of the grid is shut down, everybody's sleeping. Heat up your storage, basically a block of concrete inside the heater, and then during the day, turn on a fan to blow air over the hot rock and heat the house with it. And that allows you to use off-peak power to heat up.
Campbell, what about pumped hydroelectric?
When there is excess power on the grid, you can pump water uphill, you know, from the lower reservoir to the upper reservoir. This is done, for example, here in the San Luis Reservoir. If you go over Pacheco Pass, Route 152, that is a pumped hydroelectric scheme. Mm-hmm. They pump it up when there's excess power in the morning, and then when the sun comes up and everybody turns on their air conditioners, goes home, starts making dinner, plugs in their electric vehicle to recharge, demand goes up, they can generate power by letting the water flow downhill through the turbines and generate electricity for that much higher demand.
So Campbell, what are the factors that need to be considered when choosing an energy storage technology? Does it depend on where it will be used?
Yes, exactly. And more not where it will be used, but how it will be used. So that it has to have a capacity that is appropriate for the use. That is, you need to be able to store enough energy with the capability of delivering it fast enough to meet the power demand for long enough. So energy capacity is the first thing. And that, you know, that can vary all over the map. As you say, where is it being used? So in a single house, Powerwall might be enough. And the storage heater that we talked about, that could be just in one room. So the next thing is how long it takes to recharge and how fast it can discharge. Lead acid batteries are a good example of something that gives a lot of power over a short burst. Great for starting your internal combustion engine, not necessary for electric cars. And I've also alluded to the importance of weight, the stored energy per kilogram, where, you know, if the energy store is much more than the device that's being powered, or especially for transport and portable devices, it just doesn't work. So you've got to match the weight to the application. And as always, cost is important. If you're going to lose power and there's damage going to be done to whatever needs the power, you got to weigh that cost of that damage against the cost of installing a backup system.
Campbell, what's a microgrid and how will it help local communities during a natural calamity like the one in Texas, or if we have another horrific season of forest fires this fall here in California?
A microgrid is just really a small self-contained electrical system. It has generation capability in a house, that's the solar panels on the roof. It has storage capability, that's the power wall, the batteries where the storage is kept. And it has a distribution system, that's the wiring running through your house, taking it from the roof directly or from the batteries to the appliances that you're running. That is already a microgrid. Now, it helps to have that connected to the larger grid, so that when you run out of your own storage, you still can go get power from the local utility company. Conversely, you can give power. If you've got excess power, you can hook it up and run the meter backwards, as they say, and benefit from net energy metering. So that's what a microgrid is. And what that does is when power goes out, the safety shutdowns that PG&E is now doing during forest fires, it means you still have a local source of power. You will not suffer from these rolling blackouts or any other kind of blackout.
We, Campbell, just like you mentioned, we installed solar panels on our roof about 7 years ago, like many others here in California. And when the sun is shining, we produce enough solar energy that we almost don't pay for any electricity. Not only do I save money, but I'm also contributing towards a greener planet, and that makes me feel really good. For most folks, on the other hand, they don't really care how green their electricity is, but they do care deeply about their pocketbooks. Will people save money on the electricity bills on the long run with all these new storage solutions we've talked about for renewable energy?
Yes. So if you have solar panels on your roof, you can benefit from the cost savings that I just described. Charge it when the power is cheap and send it to the grid if you've got excess. You can make money off your solar panels. But there's more and more solar energy being generated on the utility grid. PG&E is buying solar energy from various solar generation companies. And that is cheaper, especially in the middle of the day. The demand is not yet that high. That is less expensive energy. And if you have a battery system, maybe even without solar panels, you can charge your batteries early in the day. And then when the peak prices come in, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they start charging 3-4 times as much for the energy as they did in the morning, you have your own supply, and so you're not paying peak price.
Campbell, what do you see as the future in this field? You've talked about some of it, but what technological barriers have to be crossed for green energy to replace fossil fuels as the main source of electricity in the US and around the world?
So storage is definitely the missing link, if you like. Till quite recently, that was true. But somewhere in the last decade, the price of lithium-ion batteries came down enough that they became competitive. So it's a matter of the economics as well as the technology. As I said, all the pieces are there. And especially SWB, solar wind battery, is now an acronym of increasingly common usage. And so we're on our way. It's now a matter of market forces and convincing generators of fossil energy to shut down their plants and replace them with clean energy.
So just coming back, you know, to regular folk like us, what can we do in our communities to advocate for a greener future?
The biggest problem that we have is, in my opinion, we have not moved fast enough. We've seen this coming for the last 50 years even. We've been dragging our heels, or actually we've been dragging this anchor called the fossil fuel industry. We really need to keep saving energy. You can go to clean energy in Silicon Valley. There are the green suppliers, and PG&E will deliver solar energy to your house, so you can switch to that. You can drive less, walk and bicycle for short distances. And if you're ready to buy a new car, make it electric. I would say insulating your home is really a very, very big thing. That saves you a lot of money, and it's a really fast payback. One of the first things we did when we were insulating was put infrared absorbing film on our west-facing windows. So as the sun went down in the evening, used to shine in these windows and really heat our house up. So that infrared film, it took roughly $1,000, I think, to install over all the windows that we had. So for a few $100, you can cut your power bill and contribute to saving the planet. The other thing is food waste. The U.S. population wastes, I've heard numbers as high as 10-15% of the food goes to waste. Agriculture is a big generator of greenhouse gases. So even just cutting down that waste is a contribution. Tidal wetlands are really a very efficient sink of carbon. And so advocating for the restoration of tidal wetlands would make a big impact. 2% of the area is tidal wetland. And that accounts for 50% of the carbon sequestration. Basically, what happens, the roots of these plants in the tidal wetland are submerged underground and often underwater. And when the plants die, these roots are still there. So the biomass is underground and soaked. And that means it decays anaerobically. It does not release carbon dioxide. So we can get a lot of carbon out of our atmosphere in the next few decades by restoring tidal wetlands. This is, you know, great in Santa Cruz County, San Mateo County, maybe Monterey County. The local authorities should be restoring as much tidal wetland as they can. Tell your legislature.
That's awesome.
And local too.
Yeah.
And something concrete people can do.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry, pun was not intended. No, those are all very good practical things all of us can do. And the advocacy part is very important too. It has certainly been an eye-opening conversation. And you've told us so much about what energy storage means and what we fundamentally need to do to transition to a more efficient storage model for our future. Thank you so much, Campbell. Thanks for being with us today.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
This is Desi Collective with Anjana Nagarajan Bhutani and Meera Kaima. Our guest was the climate reality activist, Campbell Scott. Tune in to our next episode of Our Climate is Changing, Why Aren't We? To learn about how you can make a difference.